Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs, as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes, we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Hope you enjoyed those excerpts from past guests. My next guest is Michael Karoff from Karoff Communications in San Diego. He's been with us several times before and always has great tips. You know, if you're in business of any type, you need to pay attention to how you communicate with the world. And at Karoff Communications, their major focus is on your sales, from the expert search team research through the sophisticated coding and link building, and finally the detailed tracking and analysis. They trace the path that delivers customers to you. Now, no other SEO company is as single-minded in this pursuit as Karoff Communications. And today we're going to talk about measuring the results of your SEO and or your pay-per-click campaign. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining me once again today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Bill?
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to have you with us. We've talked about, you know, in and around this, the idea of SEO and different types of pay-per-click campaigns. If you would, tell our listeners a little bit about you and your background and what your company does and what's important for them to pay attention to today.
Absolutely. The company got started 24 years ago in 1995 when I had a blind luck opportunity not only to build a website for a client but to promote that website to bring in new business. And it was so successful at the time that for the next 13 years, I made the bulk of my income from commissions that I made from this client. So I really was sort of set in a trial by fire. And I think that's what causes the fact that I'm so focused on the bottom line, which is sales, because for me, it was how I actually made my income. I couldn't just theoretically do well for my clients. I had to actually make it work. And I believe that has colored my experience in the company I've built since then.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's what drove your success in the past, and you realize for a lot of companies out there, they may not know what they don't know in some of these areas today. Things are changing always very rapidly. So what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see people making these days when it comes to SEO and things like pay-per-click, and how do you measure results?
The biggest mistake that I see, and there are a number of them, but the biggest mistake I see is for companies to think they can A, understand the process, and B, direct it. What happens with that is that they're trying to direct the SEO PPC agency in how to run the campaigns. And of course, since they don't really know what they're doing, they're making bad decisions. The SEO agency can either carry them out or not do it, not work with the client. If they carry them out, then the results are not surprisingly disappointing. So the main thing I would advise companies is, if you're going to hire an SEO PPC agency, find the best one you can based on reviews from other people in the business and trust them. Doesn't mean you shouldn't watch them or know what's going on, but don't try to manage the process yourself. It's counterproductive.
I think there's probably a lot of people out there that get friendly advice maybe from other business owners or other types of businesses, because there are a lot today of peer groups of business owners that get together, and a manufacturing type company, based company, might say, well, here's what you need to do, but they might be talking to a totally different type of a company or situation. So how wary should people be of that friendly advice they get from well-meaning other business owners?
Take it with a grain of salt. What is it they say? Free advice is worth what you paid for it?
Right.
Oftentimes that's true. The fact is that unless they themselves, the people giving advice, are in the business of SEO or PPC, they likely as not have at best incomplete and at worst completely wrong information. One of the things that makes it so complicated for business owners to trust an agency is that oftentimes what you're doing in SEO and PPC is counterintuitive from a gut perspective. And people who have built successful businesses have probably done it by trusting their gut, which is great. The problem is we're looking at impassionate data and using that to make decisions. Much like, let's say, a financial advisor isn't going out and buying the latest stock because they think it's cool. They're doing it based on the data. And just like you need to trust your financial advisor, you need to trust your agency to understand the data and interpret it correctly.
Good point. Everything's customizable these days. And, you know, in your world, things change rapidly. Are there new up-and-coming types of media that you think will be in vogue? You know, I'm reminded of the changes in technology over the years, and I'm an old dog, so I remember, you know, when things like the fax machine came into play, and everybody's, oh, if you want to get everybody's attention, you need to send a fax, and then everybody received so many faxes, they said, well, that's not working, so now you need to send an email, and you know, everything that's old is new again. But what's happening, it seems like we've gone from to a lot of video content, a lot of streaming content. Are those trends continuing to emerge, and is there anything new on the horizon?
They are all continuing to emerge, and there are all these new technologies and delivery systems in the market. What I think has become much more important over the last several years especially is that you need to look at a multiplicity of channels. So it used to be you could run an SEO campaign and see the results and go, that's great. Or, you know, an advertising campaign and see the results, that's great. Now, what we find with tracking is that someone who has eventually come to your site and made a contact or purchased or made an inquiry has gotten there through multiple channels. They've searched organically. They've had the results in their bookmarks. They've clicked on a pay-per-click ad or two. They have interacted with a company via social media. So you have to look at the whole picture, at the forest, as it were, and say, I can't just focus on individual trees. I have to look at how the whole forest works together as a unit. And that's tough. It's complex.
Interesting. You know, and so many of the technologies over the last few years have been new to the consumer. And as you mentioned now, the consumer is now becoming more experienced with using these various types of technologies. From a business owner's perspective, Michael, is there a simple way to connect SEO and or pay-per-click directly to sales?
There is a way to connect it. Unfortunately, there is no simple way. And I'm glad you asked this because we get asked it all the time. Essentially, the question means that we get asked is, well, what was working? Let's do that. And as I mentioned before, it's oftentimes multiple channels that have brought the consumer to your site. So, in fact, now Google in their analytics program has introduced a function called attribution. What attribution does is it says, if I had someone who came to my site and eventually filled out a form requesting more information, and they came to the site 8 times, and 3 were from organic search, 2 were from pay-per-click, 2 were from referrals from other sites, and 1 was from social media, what's the percentage of importance of each of those channels to the interaction? So it was 20% pay-per-click, 35% organic SEO, 20% social media. I think you see where I'm going with this. That's that whole picture. No one of those would have done it on its own. It's the combined efforts of all the channels, and that's where it can become very difficult to analyze. Is if I'm looking at all these channels, how can I analyze it? It's not a simple thing.
Can you, though, break it down into stages, like early on? Of course, we've all experienced, I hope it's not just me, I search for something. Next thing I know, when I'm reading a news feed or something like that, there it is. You know, it's reminding me that I looked at this, I was interested in this, and that it just won't let me forget, and then I... You know, and that's a big part of it is creating and maintaining that initial curiosity and awareness leading back to me going, okay, now I have time, now I'll click on this and look into it. And then kind of, again, leading down the path of moving towards a purchase. What would you call those different stages?
That's a really good point. And there are different stages. The first is exploration or just research. The second is looking for reviews or analyzing, you know, the consumer trying to evaluate the value of your service or product. The third is communicating with you directly, whether it's a phone call or an email form, and then finally is purchase. And you're right, each of those stages has characteristic behaviors. And each of them can involve, again, multiple channels to get there.
Interesting. Marketing's always fascinated me. It's moved well beyond the yellow pages, well beyond, and there's so much psychology that goes into these things, how you craft a message, what it looks like, to different types of consumers, right? It's become multifaceted and of course, way too complicated for the busy business owner to take on themselves. So ultimately, I think a lot of business owners, like they do many, many things, wonder, okay, how do I know if this is working? I could have a lot of exploration type of clicks, but I'm not seeing the purchases. Are they making it into the pipeline, or are they falling out somewhere? How do we demonstrate, or how do they understand if the program's working?
Good point. We use a number of tracking programs. Google Analytics is a huge one, Google Search Console, and others. And we are tracking the progress at every stage. So we can say, up to the point of them making an inquiry, what's working, how well it's working, where they're falling out of the path. Where we often lose it, unless we work with the business owner, is that last step, the actual sale. Let's suppose that the sale comes over a phone call or a meeting in person. We don't know that unless they help us tie it in. So that's where it helps for the business owner to work with the SEO company so they can tie in the actual sale back to what happened. And if we have that data from them, we can then look at it and say, here's what led up to that. And again, it's not just one tracking platform, it's multiple tracking platforms that show us how that worked.
Interesting. You know, there's what question in my mind is there hope for the small business owner competing against the Amazons of the world? Because it seems like when it comes time, they may make the product now, but when it comes time to purchase, a lot of consumers say, well, I want one throat to choke when it comes to delivery, billing, and returns in a lot of consumer purchases these days, right? So I don't want to have to worry about trying to get my money back if it's, you know, I want easy returns and on consumer goods. Now, my question is, it seems like from what I'm hearing, and we've all gone to Costco and seen Kirkland, you know, the Costco brand is everything from vodka to batteries, right? Amazon's going down that same road. What do you think, from a marketing standpoint, it looks like down the road for the small manufacturer out there competing with this behemoth delivery system?
Wow, excellent question. How many hours do I have?
Not many.
No, Bill, you've put your finger on a major concern that is worrying a lot of our clients. Is we have to sell on Amazon because we can't avoid it, and yet it's competing with our own direct sales. I don't have an easy answer for that. One of the things I think is that because Amazon is so successful, you're going to start seeing competing channels, whether it's Walmart or Costco,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Or other big companies start to compete with Amazon. So it's going to be multiple channels. Whether that will make it easier or worse for the consumer, I don't know. My guess is that part of the effect of that will be those channels competing for third-party sellers, which means they'll have to pay more than they do now. And Amazon is basically has a monopoly. So they say, you sell through us, we want to keep 55% of the sale. You have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're competing against 5 or 7 or 10 other distributors, they may have to say, okay, you know, well, we'll give you 75% of the sale instead of 45%. I hope that's a path. As far as the consumer competing online with those major channels, you just have to learn how to thread the needle to either be where they're not or to find a way to exist along with them and get consumers to come through you as well. But again, you're right. It's, mm-hmm. it's a concern and there is no easy answer.
Yeah, I think more problematic than anything else is the concern about what I would call disintermediation, which is where the business creates a product, fills a gap in the marketplace, does a lot of hard work to promote that product, and then somewhere along the channel from exploration to, as you mentioned, like reviews and demonstration to direct contact and purchase, somewhere along the line, someone else has a proprietary right in that channel and jumps on top of, for instance, here's an example. Let's say you want a swimsuit, and you find a swimsuit you like from a manufacturer that you like. You go, and you've expressed an interest, and now all of a sudden the messages start coming in from Amazon jumps in the way and says, well, here's the, have you, you're looking at swimsuits. Have you thought about these other swimsuits that are available made by other people that might be less expensive? You know what I mean? So it's kind of like that kind of lane jumping, if you will, with someone else say, well, we have a consumer. Thank you very much for getting them interested in swimsuits. Now we're going to try to sell them another brand along the way. Is there any way to protect against that in the world of SEO and pay-per-click on the path from exploration to purchase?
Unfortunately, not any really solid way that I can think of. The best way, I think, to combat that is to form a strong online relationship with your consumers when they're in the investigative stage. So maybe on your site, you have compelling content, you interact with them on social media or through the site, so that at some point the consumer feels some sense of loyalty. Now, is that going to completely counteract the convenience of Amazon? No, it's not possible. But I think you can help. You can help to keep some of the business yourself.
Michael, you always help our listeners think a little bit deeper about their how they communicate, their SEO. You do a tremendous job. And, of course, we're both members of a group called Provisors, which means that we're both well-networked. So if you're listening to this and you want help with the way you communicate, your SEO programs, your pay-per-click, there's no one better to call than Michael Karoff of Karoff Communications. Michael, I know your website is www.karoff.com, which is CAROFF.com. Would you prefer people just go there to start to get to know you better?
Absolutely. And if they want to contact me directly, all the information is on the site.
Very, very much appreciated. Great information today. Thanks so much for joining me once again.
Always great to talk to you, Bill. Thank you.
All right, and thank you for listening. It's been a pleasure to have you with me this morning, and I'm going to roll into my next guest, and he is Michael Allen Tate. He's an executive coach, strategist, and author, and we're going to be talking about his new book, The White Shirt, Find Your Peaceful and Life-Giving Career at Any Stage of Life. And he has a key focus of helping business leaders navigate career transitions. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for joining me. Very interesting book. I have a copy of it here on my desk, and I find it very interesting. There are a lot of people out there today, of course, that are employed, but they're always looking, you know, to transition up. So if you would, tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you came to get into this career, and a little. Then we'll talk about your book in a little bit.
All right. Well, thanks, Bill. Yes, my firm is, I do retained leadership development. I work with executives that are moving in, moving up, and moving on kind of in a healthy way. That's sort of the focus of my business. But the way I got in this business of career advising was when I was in my 30s, I was in a career I was felt like I was stuck in and got real frustrated and affected everything in my life. And so one day the company basically said, it's a good idea for you to leave. And my wife said the same thing. And so that kind of hit me a double whammy. And so I was going, you know, what do I do next? You know, what do I do with my career, my life, and all that? So I went to a career advisor and paid him a bunch of money to help me find my next job. And he did a couple of tests and said, you should be an HR director. And he sent out about 500 resumes. That's when he used to send resumes out. Got one resume back, got one call back and all that time. And I thought, man, what is wrong with me? I mean, I've got a master's degree and all this stuff. Why can't I find a job? And I realized it wasn't me. It was the strategy I chose, which was the worst in the world as far as using a resume to find a job. So at that point, I decided that I was going to fix that and try to keep other people from having to go through what I went through. And that's how I got in this business of career advising.
Well, that's the spray and pray strategy, right?
That's right. Yeah.
These days, you don't have to kill so many trees with it. You don't have to send out actual paper, but the people still get onto websites quite a bit. What kind of preparation should they be thinking about before they embark on the search?
Well, it's kind of like starting a business. You know, we start a business with a plan, not a brochure. So I have people I show people how to put together a plan for their next career and their next move and what they'll be doing next. And that idea of doing that after my experience came when I was, after I left the business, I was doing, I was introduced at a Chamber of Commerce meeting one time as a professional seminar giver. And I traveled and did seminars, and I was, after a seminar I'd done in one place, a little an older couple came up to me and had a furniture store in that city and said, can you help our son decide what he wants to do? And I said, what do you mean? He said, we want to leave the business. We don't know how. We don't know if our son wants to stay in it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I sat down with the son and helped him get a plan for his life first, and then we got a plan for the business. And he went on to multiply the business to four or five stores and did a great job. But that model that I used with that founding, that one business there, kind of is my business model for what I do now with people. So, and people
wow.
are kind of in transition.
Wow, so. It sounds like you've been talking to some of my clients, Michael, that they really want their, they would love for their offspring to take over the family business, but the offspring don't know if they have the appetite. And a lot of times what I found is they say, I don't want to live the life that you've lived as my parent. I've seen everything go, you know, you work tirelessly and endlessly for this business. You neglected the kids along the way. You know, you had a rough life. I don't know if I want that, but the child might not have worked anywhere else, and they don't know what else is out there. So there's a lot of soul searching.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you have something called the top five challenges that people face when they're considering a career move. What would those be?
Well, the first one is people haven't really looked inside to figure out what they want. You know, what it is that Alfred E. Newman of Mad Magazine once said that most people don't know what they want, but they're pretty sure they don't have it. And so just taking some time to look inside yourself, and I actually have people do this exercise of writing down for 2 weeks the things that you are thankful for or grateful for and the things that kind of drive you crazy in your work. And after 2 weeks, you can get real clear on what you want kind of out of your next career. But that's part of it. The other part is they use the wrong strategy, as I mentioned before, you know, the strategy of asking for a job. And the essence of my book is ask for a job, you'll get advice, ask for advice, and you'll get a job. And I teach people how to take a new approach to that. And the other is doing it alone. Changing a career is a lonely place. So having someone to work with you and be by your side, kind of help you through all that's kind of the main key in those reasons people will get held back. Yeah.
Great. So look inside. Have a strategy for getting out there. Like you said, ask for advice and get a job. And doing it alone is tough because you may not know what all is out there. You may not know what's changed. But, you know, early on what you said was kind of the look inside. And I've heard that from other people as well. It's like, you know, a lot of people these days, Michael, are starting to say, you know, I need to keep working. I need to continue income, but I'm sure tired of what I've been doing for the last 20, 30 years. What I've heard from some people is, what did you want to be when you were a child? Maybe there's something there, right?
Yeah, that's true. As a matter of fact, this is one of the first exercises in the White Shirt book is to go back and ask your parents and people who knew you, you know, what you like to do as a child. And I have folks do a career tree of their careers and their family, and it's pretty astounding to folks who have never really thought about all the careers that kind of naturally connect to them. And you probably think, well, that's a good idea for kids coming out of college. But I had a guy that was 65. He retired from a nonprofit actually a church, and he wanted to go, still wanted to work. And he looked back at his career tree. He had like six people in banking, his uncles and all that. Now he's a community banker, you know, and, you know, just by going back and saying, so what naturally, kind of what's my heritage of careers can really help you as well.
What was I wired for all of these years, all of these generations? Something has to have been built into the DNA along the way, I guess, huh?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And, you know, you grow up in it, you hear it. But the main thing is just to be aware of it, because so many people choose careers, as you probably know, Bill, from talking to folks, is how'd you become an accountant? Well, my college roommate decided to be one. He said we could make some money, so that's what I did. You know, people go into careers from peers, for profit. It's kind of usually the ones that, and then they finally got down to purpose, you know, what it is that I really want to do. Kind of like, and that usually comes from an event, kind of like what I shared with my, when I found out what languages I love that language of career and advising, like you love the language of finance and money. Yes. I'm sure there was a point when you discovered that for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I think like a lot of people, Michael, I mean, I picture, you know, I talk to a lot of children who took over businesses that are no longer children. Now they're the 65-year-olds, and they're saying, you know, I lived a comfortable life of kind of quiet desperation. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, we hear about the whole, you know, everybody gets a trophy kind of a parenting generation that's now growing up. And I hear a lot of people saying, follow your passion. But the problem is sometimes people need to recognize that their passion may be better as a hobby. You can do your passion as a hobby if it doesn't sustain a lifestyle, right?
Right. Yeah, you have to find a passion and somebody will pay you for it, for sure. And but, you know, passion, that word passion, you know, is kind of taking on this connotation of enjoyment or pleasure, but it really, you know, passion's pain. And a career usually goes around helping, you know, a point of, you found a point of pain where you recognize there was a need, and that other people have that same point of pain that you're helping them get through. So that's why I kind of think about passion in a little different way. And those usually continue if you can hold on to that one thing that kind of drove you there. What's your, as we always say in business, what's your founding story? You know, where did it all start? And you know, can you find that need that repeats over and over?
Yeah, I struggle with this sometimes today because I see a lot of, and again, in family businesses, a lot of times it's like, my scope of my job sometimes starts with, can you see if the SOB is going to become the CEO or not? And the SOB is the son of boss, okay, in my nomenclature.
Right, yeah.
Because that's what all the employees call him, the SOB. But he's the son of the boss. And the question is, can that son or daughter, can they become the leader of this business at some point? And you know what? Guess what? A lot of times they don't have that in them. And so then it becomes a question of, well, then we're going to have to sell the business. So now we need to figure out what that young person should do with the rest of their life. And that's where people like you come in to say, well, let's just hold on a second. Don't rush out and get the first job you see. Let's sit back and think about this and what's good for you. It may not be, you know, for instance, I play music. That's my passion, but it's a hobby. I played last night. I made $100. I mean, I'm not going to live on that. But I thoroughly enjoyed the time I was able to do that just last night. But for many people, they're going to have to find something. It might be in the realm of helping people. You can help people a lot of different ways if that's your passion.
Sure can, yeah.
So you have something that's called, it's the unconventional approach that works 85% of the time. Can you describe that for our listeners? That sounds intriguing.
Yes. The thing that works 85% of the time is to develop a one-page career strategy that If you go on my website, you can see examples of these. On one side, it says, here's a couple lines about my background. Here's where I want to live geographically. Here are the kind of industries I think I would work in. Here are my basic skills and talents. And on the right-hand side of that page is a list of target organizations or types of businesses that you share. And so that's the one-page plan. And you go and share that plan and ask people for advice rather than asking them for a job, because you know that if someone comes to you with a resume in their hand, they are, as we call it, you're at that point a job beggar. We say approach job search as a research project. I'm here doing some research. I'd like your advice on my plan. I don't expect you to know of any job openings. I'm not expecting you to know of anybody that's hiring. Just look at this and tell me who would you suggest I talk to about my plan. And that works. It's worked for ages. It works in my little book, and it works in life. So that is the key to all of it is asking for advice, not asking for a job. Because when you ask for a job, you get advice. As for advice, you get a job lead most of the time.
That's terrific. It's a great idea. You're coming in. It's kind of intentional networking, if you will. You're coming in with a purpose, but you're by having people that know the lay of the land. Maybe other opportunities can come up if you just approach it properly, and that's terrific. When you work with individuals and executives, is it often around this topic? It's because I talk to a lot of business owners, Michael. Here's my my question is, and they say, I want to get, they talk to me when they want to get out of their business, right? They say, look, in the next 3 to 5 years, I don't want to be doing this anymore. I want to pass on the leadership and the assets but I don't want to stop living. I don't want to retire. I want to rewire. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you work with people in that realm, when should they start thinking of that and getting to that mindset in advance of whenever their exit timeline might be? How soon?
At least 3 years at the latest to really be thinking about it and start putting together some of your ideas of a plan and your thoughts about the things you'd like to do. Most of my work is retained. I work for corporations, and I spend a third of my time with one-on-one with people, a third of my time with their team, and a third of my time with the boards of directors working with them. So, and I'm working with CEOs and people who are leaving and trying to get folks ready to go. The hardest thing to do, as you know, is to say, give me a date. Let's imagine a date out here. Now, if we imagine that date, let's talk about what that might look like, how you might spend a week, start kind of it's just like, just like when people start a new job. I work with new leaders coming in to organizations, and I say, let's write a hypothesis of what you think it'll be like for the first year, and then test that hypothesis as you go forward. So it's the same sort of idea is, let's just explore with that what that would look like, but let's put something down on paper that you can start thinking about, and not even sharing that with people then, but just kind of that at least 3 years ahead is ideal.
I really like that idea. I talk to a lot of owners, unfortunately, Michael, that say, I would leave, but I don't know what else I would do, and I'm afraid of that unknown. So if they can start to do some research and do things like read your book and work with people like you to say, I really need to figure out what drives me forward from here, and then I can start to try it on, research it. And then there, in the groups that I'm in that deal with exit planning, they say one of the key reasons business owners hold on too long on their business and don't exit is because they don't have a sense of what they'll do next.
Absolutely.
So
yep.
Huge numbers of people with a lot more life left than they used to have at retirement age. Your life expectancy is 20, 30 years. It's a long time. So it's a pivotal time. I know that AARP takes on this project for people. They call it, I think it's Life Reimagined. Within that, you need listeners, you need expert advice, and that's where Michael Allen Tate comes in. Michael, I know your website is, as your name, MichaelAllenTate.com, Michael, A-L-A-N, Tate, T-A-T-E, .com. And your book is called The White Shirt, and I imagine it's available wherever books are available.
Right, it is, and it's at Amazon, all the bookstores. It's also just went Audible last week, so you can get it as an Audible book. On my website, though, I do have a the website for the book is whiteshirtbook.com, whiteshirtbook.com. And if you go there, we actually have a special promotion for listeners who would be interested in a I have a free workbook that you can use to take yourself through the 7 steps that are in the book and actually develop your plan in 7 to 14 days. So that if you go to the whiteshirtbook.com and click on the gift for podcast listeners, you can see that, and that'll be my gift for anyone who'd like to receive that.
Well, I sure appreciate that. I know I will be telling listeners, but also telling clients that, you know, they absolutely have to start this parallel path of thinking very seriously about their future after their business. And again, you don't have to be a departing business owner. You might want your children or others in your business to read this as well, to help getting really a concrete strategy for moving forward. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
And listeners, thank you very much for listening today. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us. But we're not done yet. My next guest is Kathleen McEntee from Kathleen McEntee and Associates Limited. She has been on the show before, and she's the founder and president of Kathleen McEntee and Associates Limited, a full-service marketing firm that provides branding and logo development, messaging, marketing collateral, and PR, along with online presence through social media, website development, and reputation management to businesses. She's best known for her ability to quickly understand a business by listening to business needs so that she can develop a plan that focuses on the customer experience, and she and her firm help clients open the door to their target markets and really understand exactly what they're doing with their marketing. So, Kathleen, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me once again.
It's my pleasure entirely, Bill.
Well, thank you. I really got so many great comments from our last interview. Wanted to have you back on, and I see we have a pretty good agenda here. But before we jump into that, can you just fill our listeners in a little bit more about how you got started in this career, and a little bit more about what you do for your clients?
Sure. I was in corporate America for a very long time, mostly on the sales side, eventually taking on the marketing initiatives as well. And after 20-something years in sales and marketing for corporate America, I'm pretty vocal. So after fighting the bureaucratic and political battles internally, I figured we were spending too much time fighting each other than fighting the competitors. So I decided to jump off the cliff, get out of that maelstrom, and do it for clients who really wanted to focus on their on strategy. So I started out helping clients with strategy, but what I really found rewarding and what they really needed was to be able to talk about who they are, what they did, and most importantly, what distinguished themselves from the competition. Because business owners today, you know, they know how to talk about their company to people they're familiar with and the products they make. But sometimes it's hard to get it, you know, to kind of crystallize it all so that people get what you do and get what makes you different. And that's really where we're focused on. So I kind of evolved into full-service marketing. And so we provide everything from logo and branding to marketing collateral, website design, social media, and PR. So we provide really a full service. We can be an outsourced marketing department, support an in-house marketing department, or work on projects that that clients want to use. But our focus really is helping organizations distinguish themselves from their competition.
You know, that makes a tremendous difference in whether a company succeeds or not, how consumers gather a first impression about a company and what their business is called. And I've noticed just recently a lot of big financial companies have changed their names to appeal to a new emerging crowd of consumers. For instance, I'll give you an example. ING, a big insurance company and financial services company, changed their name to Voya just recently. Another one, because this is the world that I'm in, MetLife changed to Brighthouse. And it leaves you just scratching your head sometimes wondering, number one, how can you abandon a brand and how can you choose another name like that? That just must be such a difficult process to try to figure out, okay, here's what we did for the last 100 years, here's what we're going to do for the next 100 years. At what point does a company start to think, maybe my brand name isn't working and I need a new one?
You know, you bring up an interesting point, because we went through this with a client about a year ago. Here's the thing. Today, you really have to reach your audience how you have to kind of get in the mindset of your audience in order to reach them. So what are they going to get about your company that you want them to get? And sometimes, I mean, it's like anything else. Look at Federal Express changed to FedEx. United Parcel
yep.
Service changed to UPS. Today, probably half the users of FedEx and UPS have no idea that that used to be the name. Marriott just changed their reward system to Bonvoy, and I thought, how ridiculous is that? But you know what? It's a short acronym for Bon Voyage. So, you know, larger companies can do that. I mentioned we just went through that with a smaller firm who's actually in financial services. They're financial advisors. And they brought us in to take a look at, you know, what they did and their firm name. And the owner of the firm said, do anything you want. If you think we need to change the name of our company, let's do that. I'm very reluctant to do that sort of thing, because that is a major, major undertaking and a huge hassle, especially in financial services when you have to change everything around,
get involved with
the SEC and whatnot. But we changed, and they said, we don't want our name on the firm. We want our firm to make an impact so that people understand what we're doing. And so we – can I name the firm? And then
sure.
I'll give you an example.
Okay with me.
Is that okay? Okay.
Yes.
So the name of the firm was Foothill Financial, and they're located over in Claremont.
Uh-huh.
And they had a really good reputation in Claremont, but as the owner said, Foothill means absolutely nothing to anybody. Well, we all kind of know it's the Foothills, but the broader you expand your base, the less people know what that means.
Yes.
And so at first I was very reluctant, and I said, you know, we could do a lot with, you know, with a logo and messaging. I don't know that this is what you want to do. Well, we retained a lawyer and had the lawyer look into it, and sure enough, there were other people who kind of had the same name, even though they started after us. There would have been a big whole thing to try to unravel that. And he said, you know what, let's just change the name and be done with it. So we came up with several names that would be meaningful. We went through a process. We talked about who is our client and, you know, what would be meaningful to them. And then, you know, many times the name of a firm can be taken out of something they're already doing, but they kind of don't see that. So as we were going through all of their processes that they use to meet with clients, one of the processes is a questionnaire. You know, tells everything about yourself, what your assets are, what are your liabilities, how many kids do you have, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the name of the questionnaire was the Life Steps Questionnaire. And I looked at it and I said to them, here's the name of your firm, Life Steps. And so Life Steps, the Life Steps Questionnaire, has evolved into Life Steps Financial. And it makes perfect sense because if you get a financial advisor early to help you, you know, focus and preserve and increase your wealth, they're going to walk through life steps with you. And it was a huge undertaking. They had a lot of work to do on the back end. But you know what? The transition was a lot easier than we had ever anticipated. I mean, it took a few weeks for us to be answering the phones, life steps, and all that sort of thing. It took
right.
several announcements. We had to have, we mailed it, we emailed it, we broadcasted it on social media. We had a whole plan together. We made a press release, all that sort of new website. But at the end of the day, the transition was good, and the name now resonates with clients of theirs and prospects. They kind of know what they do before they even get there. So,
and it doesn't have the connotation of being a kind of a geographical location, like, oh, we're in the, like if we were Glendale Financial, for instance, as an example, or
exactly.
or another mistake people seem to make a lot, and that is to brand it after their name, which
yeah.
we talk a lot about sustainability, which is, are you a 100-year company? Or is your company, are people going to be, you know, wondering where is John Smith if you're John Smith Financial?
Right.
50, you know, are you doing this for ego, or is this really a sustainable brand? Can you talk about that a little bit? Because we see a lot of firms changing from names to initials or other iterations of that.
Yeah, I think it depends on what your mindset is and where you want your the direction of your company to lead. When I started my firm, which we're going into our 16th year now, when I started my firm, everybody said, and I kind of didn't know the direction I was going to head because I thought I was going to be focusing on strategy and it would be me, an assistant, and it's kind
yeah.
of evolved from there. And so everybody said, do not put a name to your company. Put your name on the company because you are what's powering the strategy behind the company. So that's what I did. And for the first few years, I was very self-conscious about it. But for me, this works well because I am powering the company because I do all the strategy. We have people to do kind of the underlying work, but I do the strategy. I don't have visions of growing my firm into a national firm. I've been there and done that, and I have no interest
yes.
in that.
Right.
Conversely, though, if someone had an interest, if you have a product or a service that you want to scale nationally and internationally to become a large firm, then there's an opportunity to switch from having your name on the firm to either initials or something that's much more meaningful that can resonate with your client base. So I think it depends upon really the direction you want to take your firm.
It makes total sense. I mean, there's different reasons for doing different things. The whole concept of marketing seems to be changing like every day. What are some of the latest trends that you're seeing or where should businesses place emphasis these days?
I think that probably the three top things that people need to be focused on in marketing is talking to the audience. You see so much promotion, advertising, you know, no matter where you see mm-hmm. it, talking almost like in the third person, like talking about a company, rather than using language that will resonate with their audience. They know who their audience is, whether the audience is a millennial, whether the audience is a business owner, whether the audience is an engineer. so many, those that are most successful in their marketing efforts are talking straight, are identifying who their audience is and then talking to them. And if they have different audiences, they're identifying those audiences and the medium, those audiences where they want to reach them, and they're talking to an audience in a medium so that that company makes sense. That's probably the most important, one of the most important trends right now. And the other thing is the customer experience. So many firms think that the customer experience kind of begins when they've sold, you know, when they've closed the sale. The customer experience begins when a firm's name is a twinkle in a prospect's eye. So it's the first time they see an ad online, or the first time they see a press release, or the first time they meet someone. And then it's all through the customer experience, not only when they've sold the customer, through the delivery of the product or service, and more importantly, afterwards. So now some are overkill. You know, every time I turn around, I'm getting, could you please give us a survey? Tell us what you like. I mean, sometimes, you know, that's ad nauseum. And then you tend to wipe that out. But by and large, the customer experience today is more important than ever. And we can thank Amazon for that, right? So Amazon has transformed the customer experience. And whether you compete with Amazon or not, they have transformed the expectations of the customer. And so that is kind of like the second trend. And then the third thing is video, video, video. People are engaging, and people are paying more attention to videos than they are for static information than ever before. And videos need not be high-tech, professionally produced, scripted, and all that sort of thing. Yesterday, we were actually at LifeSteps because we shot five videos. I shot five videos. We're going to polish them up. We're going to edit them a little bit, and we're going to put those in our social media mix, because they don't have to be so much high-tech. Sometimes high-tech turns people off because it's staged.
Yes.
Sometimes you just need to hear people from the heart, and video will do that.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about a new concept that seems to be emerging. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's an insurance-based commercial with Dennis Quaid, a series of commercials with Dennis Quaid on TV now, and they're all about lifting the veil, about letting the, for instance, there's a commercial where he's talking about insurance on his cell phone. He says, "Don't worry, I'm not really on the phone," and it backs away to show him being towed, his car being towed by a film crew. In other words, lifting the veil and letting people in on the making of the technical making of the commercial. He calls people by their script names, like, nice to see you, actor number two, or something like that. And so this whole lifting the veil and letting the public in on that, is that a clever play, or is it, you know, I don't even know what insurance company it represents, to be honest. A lot of commercials seem to be like that. It's more about the memorable entertainment. Now, Geico's been brilliant with the Gecko, right? Is this what we're going to see more and more of? Is like, what did they just advertise? But I liked it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I think the concept is terrific. And that's really where the creatives come in. Because I'm not creative like that. I'm pretty creative, but that dynamicism really isn't my strong suit. I really like when people can bring in those clever aspects of advertising, because the key is to make it memorable. And that whole unveiling thing and making it less formal, more casual, more speaking to the audience is indeed going to engage the audience.
Yeah, the audience might take away, well, these guys seem to be straight shooters. They don't hold back anything. It's not too polished.
Yep.
And you know, being different sometimes means being a little bit unusual, but of course, keeping things simple. As always, I just saw some political commentary saying, you know, how great political slogans throughout the years have always been three or four words. You know, it's got to be pertinent, memorable, and succinct. But is there a place for old-fashioned marketing like brochures and print ads and things like that these days? Is there any more room for those, or are they outdated?
Well, think about it. You know, we're bombarded. I think the last statistic that I saw was we're bombarded with 12,000 messages a day in advertising, right? So from the time you get up in the morning, either you're turning on the TV or you're listening to the radio, you're going to the coffee pot, you see the Folgers sign on the can, all that sort of stuff, until you close the light at night when you hop into bed, you're bombarded with messages. So up until about 2-3 years ago, the statistics were that you had to see a message 7 times for it to go from the back of your mind to the front of your mind. Well, now it's 21 times. So you have to see that message 21 times for someone to be memorable and top of mind. And think about it. Consumers accept information in different ways. So I'm online all day long because we do a lot via email and connecting with our clients and, you know, with our team and whatnot. The last thing I want to do is read the news online. Not interested. So
yeah.
I'm watching the TV news, right? Other people thrive on reading the news online. Sometimes I just want to sit down and flip through a magazine. I don't want to be bothered with that. Other people like all those kind of ads. And if you think about it, think of the mail you get in your business these days. We really don't get a lot of direct mail anymore.
Right.
So direct mail is on the rise, believe it or not. We just issued a direct mail for a client who wanted to be in a very specific, targeted, like a gated community. They wanted to drop a message to their members in that community. Direct mail was the best way to do that. So, and print, you know, if you're in the medical business, many times, like I live in the Palm Springs area, one of the hospitals here produces a great magazine to either former patients or patients that are part of, you know, doctors' practices and whatnot, and or friends of the community. And that gets a huge, huge readership, and the advertisers get a huge uplift because it's a very targeted magazine. We advertise in that for one of our other clients. And so it really depends. There is a place for what I'll call the old-fashioned marketing way. It has to be targeted. You have to have a strategy behind it. There has to be a reason. But everything can live side by side, you know, in today's thriving economy and thriving consumer and business community, because we now have to get to them 25 times.
That's amazing. And I've heard that, you know, that 12,000 marketing messages, I think I heard it when it was a much smaller number years ago. Of course, it grows exponentially, but and the key takeaway there was that's more impressions than our grandparents saw in a year. It's just our filters have gotten that much better, so that's why things that seep in to our memory, like, you know, the whatever it is that you might have searched for now shows up in your newsfeed as a Google ad. It's just incredible how things are keeping up. So if you're listening to this and you haven't had fresh eyes on your logo, your marketing campaign, maybe even your brand name, you should have someone get in touch with you and look at that. And no one's better at that than Kathleen McEntee. I've really enjoyed our last couple of interviews and the great tips that you've brought to our listeners, Kathleen. So I really appreciate you coming on board and helping me again today. What's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you and find out more about you?
You can reach me at via email. Probably the best way is to go to our website, kmcenteassoc.com. And it would be info@kmcenteassoc.com. Or they can call me directly at area code 760-262-4060.
Well, there you go, listeners. Please get in touch with Kathleen. And Kathleen, thank you so much. I hope that we get a chance to talk again soon, and you do a great job of keeping us up to date on this ever-changing subject. So once again, thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill, and you have a good day.
Thanks. Okay, listeners, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every